Hey, good afternoon, Juno. It's a couple of seconds before 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska, and this is Juneau Afternoon. Pat Moore, your host today. I have a great lineup of guests for us today. Five people will be appearing on the show, at least. Kathy DiLorenzo is here with Katie Giorgio. Kathy is in charge of the Masters in Public Administration program at UAS, and Katie is one of her students. Elfrieda Nort will drop in briefly to tell us about the Scandinavian Culture Fair Saturday, and we'll have folks here from the Juneau Student Symphony to tell us about Saturday's concert at 4:30 in the afternoon. The fireside lecture tonight at 6:30 and 8 p.m. is going to be Aaron Hood and Shad O'Neill talking about the impacts of glacier state change out at Mendenhall Glacier Visitors Center. We'll talk to them briefly, and folks from Marie Drake Planetarium will be here to tell us about Dennis Mamana. He may be coming on the air too, and he'll be here as a special guest of Juneau for the next several days. So stay tuned for Juneau Afternoon. Right now it's time for National Native News.
Native Voice 1. The Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. People across Indian country are celebrating the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act. President Obama expressed his commitment to tribes before signing the bill Thursday in Washington, D.C.
Tribal governments have an inherent right to protect their people, and all women deserve the right to live free from fear, and that is what today is all about.
Tribal leaders, advocates, and domestic abuse survivors were among those invited to watch the signing ceremony. Sarah Deer, an associate professor at William Mitchell College of Law, was one of them.
Well, it was a very special day. It was a symbolic victory and a practical victory. And just getting to see the attention that the executive branch is directing to Native women's issues is always very fulfilling and exhilarating.
New provisions allows tribes to prosecute non-natives who commit domestic violence on tribal lands. Deer says the next step for tribes is to come into compliance with the new law.
Tribes are going to have to pass specific laws and also make sure they have some kind of a public defender program or an option for appointing counsel to indigent defendants. And those kinds of things might take a while. So I don't think we're going to see immediate response in the sense that tomorrow we'll see a tribe prosecute a non-Indian.
Deer says it could take anywhere from 6 months to a year to see tribes exercise the new provisions. Activist training is taking place in South Dakota. As Jim Kent reports, participants will learn how to take direct action on environmental issues, like TransCanada's Keystone XL pipeline, a concern among many Native people.
A three-day conference is being held on the Pine Ridge Reservation for anyone interested in stopping the Keystone XL pipeline. Lakota activist Deb Whiteplume says the theme is moccasins on the ground.
I think the point to activism and people involving themselves in it is taking responsibility for their lands, their homes, their communities. And with this effort to protect our water, we have tried every avenue. We have tried intervening in the process. We have tried doing the public comment period and participating in the environmental impact statement. And every door has been closed to us. The only door that is left open is the door of direct action. So we're preparing for that.
Whiteplume says that nonviolent direct action will involve those opposing the pipeline putting their moccasins on the ground in front of TransCanada heavy equipment.
And if they think they're going to come into this country, even if President Obama says yes, we're going to say no.
The activist training conference will also focus on community organizing to battle environmental issues like the many proposed Black Hills uranium mines. For National Native News, I'm Jim Kent.
Cherokee Nation citizen Sierra Fields receives a Champion for Change medal. The 14-year-old from Fort Gibson, Oklahoma, was one of five Native youth awarded this week in Washington, D.C. The cancer survivor was honored for raising awareness about the disease.
Whenever everyone thinks about cancer, they think old people or elders, and they don't think it's something that's going to affect our younger generations. And that's one of the reasons why it's so hard to spot in kids, because we don't look for it. Just the broad subject of cancer in general really should be talked about more.
The eighth grader shared the comments on the talk show Native America Calling. During this month in 1891, Congress set aside land for the Annette Island Reserve in southeast Alaska for Tsimshian people who immigrated there from Canada. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Every Alaskan can support causes and organizations they care about when they file for a permanent fund dividend. Use PIC-CLIC-GIVE when filing online for your PFD. When you select KNBA-FM, Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, you support National Native News. With one donation at a time, good things will happen all over Alaska. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
6 minutes after 3 o'clock, you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore, your host today for Juneau Afternoon. My first two guests are two folks from the University of Alaska Southeast, although one of them is only up there some of the time. Dr. Kathy DiLorenzo is here. She is the new person in charge, I guess relatively new recently.
I've been about 5 years.
Oh, really? That long? Okay. Well, for the last 5 years, Kathy's been running the Masters in Public Administration program up at UAS. And this is an interesting program because not every school has an MPA program. And a lot of people get it confused with an MBA. And with her is Katie Giorgio, and she is one of the students in the program. Just started this fall, came up to us from Boston, and is taking one class at a time and works full-time at the
Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation.
Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. So this is a kind of an interesting program. I remember when I did my master's degree, it was full-time, five courses a semester and that kind of thing. So this takes a little longer and it's a little bit different. Can you explain briefly why we have one of these programs and what it is for?
Oh, absolutely. We have one of these programs in Alaska because Alaska's public sector is a very large and growing part of Alaska, of the economy, of the culture and social construct of Alaska. And so we provide a master in public administration. Is an applied master's program in management for public sector and nonprofit employees. It's like an MBA in terms of being focused on management and the general considerations of being a manager, all different parts of the organization, from how we understand how we staff our organizations through human resources, to how we organize the structure of our organizations through communication lines, leadership, those types of things, how we evaluate programs, how we understand the budget and the financial aspects of it, the economics of what we do in the public sector. The public sector in Alaska is very vast and provides a crucial element and conduit from the people to be able to live in the very remote and vast and diverse areas that we have and still be connected to services that are provided, be able to have roads and be able to have ways to get fuel and supplies in and out. And so we, being a distance program, it's a very we feel it's a very important component of what we do here in Alaska. We reach into communities. We're in 22 communities in the state of Alaska in the Yukon Territory, and we reach into those communities and provide real-time classes through various distance technologies, where students who work in similar fields of management in the public sector are in class together, sharing ideas, sharing things that they do, learning theory, integrating that with practice, and we want them to be working. They work full-time. They want balanced lives. They want to be able to have an education, have access to a master's program, a quality program, and still have their lives, still have their families, still have their work, lives that are so important to them, and be able to fit this program in and connect with people all across the state of Alaska and the Yukon Territory.
So now, Katie, she said it's a distance program. Mm-hmm. Do you attend by distance, or are you sitting in a classroom while you're hooked up to the distance system?
I do attend class at UAS. I can, if I choose to, do it from home. We have other Juno students who do the program from home. They don't come to class. There's one student who lives in North Douglas, so it's a little bit far for her, after a full day on Monday, which is when we have our class, the intro to public administration, for her to drive out to UAS. But I've been out of my bachelor's for 11 years now. And so going back into a master's program, I was really excited to be back in school again. And I wanted the FaceTime with the professor, with the other students. But I do know that if I were sick, I just didn't feel like it one night. I could just be in my pajamas at home attending class, maybe with a glass of wine. Who knows?
I'm getting a great image here. But we need television instead of radio. Anyway, so when you're attending like that, and you're in the classroom, and there's someone on a television screen, do you actually see the other students, or are they just audio? Or
it's really interesting, Pat. I haven't ever been in an environment like this before. So Kathy's in front, and she's being filmed. I think there's student staffers that are up in the booth, yeah, sort of running the show. And then we have a live chat that's going on through the UAS online website. So when I attend class, I bring my laptop and I have it set up with that online chat because we don't right now have the technology to hear and see the other students that are in Fairbanks and Bethel and other places. But we can all still be in this online chat communicating. They're asking questions. They get into little debates with each other on there sometimes. It's really interesting. It does still feel, I believe we have 11 students in the class, and it still feels like while I might be one of two or three students in the actual classroom, we're still really all together in real time on the internet.
Yeah. When you were in your bachelor's program, was that were your classes in a classroom?
Oh, yes.
Okay. So can you compare the two experiences since you've now had a little shot of both kinds?
It's very different. And also, my bachelor's, I was a bachelor of music history at Rice University, so it was very much a performance-based. I played trombone in most of my classes or some kind of music. So this is very different from what my bachelor's was. And we had a very rigorous academic experience at Rice too. And so it's been an interesting comparison, the distance environment versus, and really a performance environment when I had my bachelor's degree.
We're not going to know for a while because you probably have to take a few other courses. Could you make any comments about the relative effectiveness of the two different modalities for instruction?
Well, I think there are apples and oranges a little bit just because of the nature of what we're trying to accomplish. I think in the public administration program, as Kathy said, we're sort of unique in Alaska that we're really far apart, but we're all trying to sort of accomplish the same thing. And pulling us all together in that environment, I think, is only going to help strengthen what we need to do in our professional careers, is pulling together these communities that are really far apart through technology so we can work together, that you have someone in Ketchikan and in Kotzebue, working on maybe a project together. I don't know. Okay. Yeah.
So you can do that. In other words, you could have, like, students all over the state working on a common project and getting in touch outside of class by the Internet or something like that.
Absolutely. We have two different delivery methods right now, and Katie is describing our streaming video method. We also have a web meetings approach as well, which is run through a university platform right now called Illuminate. It's similar to any web meeting. It's a bit similar to any web meeting that you would have in an organization in terms of, like GoToMeeting or something like that, where you have a platform where people can share documents and can actually have camera at some point and voice inside of that as well. And that's the other technology that we do. And in that, you can actually put people into groups. You can put them into virtual groups, and they're in those groups talking with each other, sharing information, passing information back and forth and working on things, and then you can bring them back into the big room that we share and the virtual room and then have them report out and have them talk about the things that they've done. So what we're trying to do in the Master of Public Administration program at UAS is to simulate the classroom environment as much as we possibly can, but not just simulate because we're an applied master's degree and we market specifically to working professionals who can One of the interesting questions, and I will steal your thunder, but you were going to ask what our students can do with this degree after they get done.
It's coming.
And it's kind of unique. It's not like a bachelor's program where they're going to get out and then begin their journey to look for a job and use the skills that they've gotten. Most of the students, over about 80% of the students that come into us have the job that they want or are very near the job that they want. They're working in the field that they enjoy. They are working in their communities, giving their skills and their attributes back to their communities by filling these important public service roles. And what this degree does is connect all of them together to share information about how we do things in Alaska with that master's theoretical and application approach, that integration of theory and practice. And when they come out, they have a better opportunity to move up through the organizations that they already love and know they want to be with. They have the ability to pursue maybe a different avenue within the profession that they've chosen. And we give them kind of the skills to be able to represent themselves, to be able to advance in the way that they want to.
Kathy, I'm sure we've made some people interested in this program. And
well,
because you have some summer classes that are basically open to the public, because they're elective-type classes, they might be a chance for someone to have a taste of the program. Could you, very briefly, because we're almost out of time, tell us a little bit about that summer offering?
I will. So we have recently brought in a concentration in natural resource management, and we are offering one of those classes this summer. It's called adaptive management. It's based in sustainability concepts and resiliency theory, and Jim Powell is going to be teaching that class for us. It's a great class, and it's part of our concentration. We have a class taught by Peggy Weaver, a local person who has a background in labor relations, and she's teaching a personnel law class and focusing on human resource law. And I'm teaching a fun class in public policy where we're going to construct a lens to evaluate public policy, and then we're going to just go out into the environment and grab a bunch of public policies that people are interested in and evaluate them through the lens that we've created through the class of how to create good public policy, sustainable public policy.
All right. The program is the Masters in Public Administration at UAS. Dr. Kathy DiLorenzo is in charge of the program, and Katie Giorgio, who's been our guest today, is one of the students in the program. Take a look at it at UAS.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday, the 8th of March, 2013. It was on this day, 1935, Thomas Wolfe's novel of Time and the River was published. His editor was Maxwell Perkins, who got the first draft, more than 1 million words, and still growing. Perkins and Wolfe met almost every day, while Perkins read through every page, red pencil in hand, slashing many of the pages from corner to corner, Wolfe arguing with these deletions, coming in with new material, which Perkins rejected. The book turned out to be 912 pages long, and Wolfe dedicated it to Perkins, and the dedication was almost 100 words long. Of Time and the River was a commercial success. It got mostly good reviews, but Thomas Wolfe was wounded by the negative ones, and he became convinced that Perkins had ruined his book. He left Perkins for a new editor 3 years later, dying of tuberculosis at the age of 37. He sent his last letter apologizing to Perkins and thanking him once again. It's the birthday of Kenneth Graham, born in Edinburgh, Scotland, 1859, raised by his grandmother in an old house in the south of England with a big attic and a garden near the River Thames and the Bisham Woods. The family had lost its fortune. Graham couldn't go to college. At the age of 19, got a job at the Bank of England. He was nostalgic for his childhood, and he collected wooden toys and stuffed animals, which filled his flat. And he wrote several books glorifying childhood, the Golden Age, Dream Days. When he was 38, still a bachelor, he met a woman named Elspeth Thompson. They married. They had a son named Alistair, who was in poor health, blind in one eye. Graham told his son bedroom stories about a character named Mr. Toad, and he wrote these stories down, collected them in a book, The Wind in the Willows. It got terrible reviews, and it became a classic. And it's the birthday of John McPhee, born Princeton, New Jersey, 1931. Journalist, written about canoes, basketball, oranges, geology, tennis, nuclear energy, the Swiss Army, and his own family tree, which he traced back to a Scotsman who moved to Ohio to become a coal miner. One of his high school English teachers required her students to write 3 compositions a week, each accompanied by a detailed outline, and McPhee still writes from an outline. He wanted to write for The New Yorker, which rejected his work for 14 years, until in 1962 he sold them a profile of a Princeton basketball player named Bill Bradley. He's published more than 25 books. His most recent collection is Silk Parachute. Here's a poem for today by Joyce Sutphen, Snow at the Farm. My father gets his tractor out. It's winter, finally, the first big snow of the year, and he is 84. He does not leap into the seat the way that I remember, but once he's there, he pulls down the brim of his cap, and all in one his legs and arms work at clutches, throttles, and levers, as he pushes and loads the snow into neat hills at the edge of the yard. The sun is a bright shield in the sky, something I cannot bear to look at, and the snow is so white that it shows black where the plow cuts in. From the kitchen window, I watch the red tractor moving back and forth through the blue and white world, my father's hands at the wheel. Snow at the Farm, a poem by Joyce Sutphen from First Words, published by Red Dragonfly Press, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, offering poetry podcasts to listen to and thousands of poems to read at poetryfoundation.org. And by the Mosaic Foundation of Rita and Peter Hayden, based in Ann Arbor, honoring the literary arts and the universe of great ideas. Produced by Joy Biles, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
22 minutes after 3 o'clock, you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. This is Juneau Afternoon. Pat Moore, your host. My next guest is here to tell us about a hands-on Scandinavian culture fair, which will be held this Saturday at the Juneau Yacht Club from 1 to 4 in the afternoon. Welcome, Elfrida North. Welcome back, Elfrida North. You're becoming a regular on KTOO.
Thank you.
Anyway, so tell us what's going to what we can do when if we go to the...
Well, if you come, you can... make your own lefse, potato lefse. You can make your own kromkake. There may be, I'm not sure yet, there may be an opportunity to try rosmaling.
What is that?
it's the scroll painting kinds of, very beautiful, very Norwegian. Those are them, and we will also, you can check out genealogy. Those are the ones that I know are hands-on. We will also have games and things for the children that come. There will be Scandinavian music for sure.
We're going to have a sample of that at the end of our discussion here. Now, this is put on by the Sons of Norway Svalbard Lodge. Why is it named that?
It was named Svalbard Lodge because at the time when it was founded in 1934, it was the furthest north lodge in the whole Sons of Norway organization. And Svalbard is the northernmost part of Norway.
So do people in Svalbard know that that there's a lodge here named for them?
There may be. Maybe they do.
Okay. And you have quite a number of members. It's a pretty good-sized organization.
We have about 100 members.
Do you have to be of Norse descent in order to be a member?
No, you don't have to be of Norse descent. You have to have an interest in the Norwegian culture. We have quite a few Danes, Swedes, other, not Norwegian, because we're the only Scandinavian organization in Juneau.
So what about an Irish lad, darling?
If you're interested, we would let you come and join us.
Well, the event is the Scandinavian Culture Fair. It's Saturday at the Juneau Yacht Club, and it starts at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. Lots of opportunities to actually put your hands on a number of Norwegian foodstuffs, right. Other crafts, art, and to hear some excellent Norwegian music.
Yes. Our goal is to get people to the International Sons of Norway has a program of cultural skills. We have 14 different cultural skills. We try to encourage people to do self-study.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's our goal, is to get people going, learning these skills themselves, not just coming to a demonstration.
Well, wonderful. Come out and try learning some Norwegian skills at
right.
the Scandinavian Culture Fair, Saturday 1 to 4 at the Juneau Yacht Club. Thank you, Elfrida.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
It's about 26 and a half minutes after 3 o'clock in the afternoon. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. This is Juneau Afternoon. Pat Moore, your host today. And I have guests here in the studio who are kind of getting set to talk even as I make this announcement. There's a wonderful concert coming up this weekend. I guess it's Saturday. Is that... I don't have everybody on. Let's turn on all the microphones, and now here we are.
Sunday at 4:30 at Glacier Valley.
Okay, and the voice, of course, is the director thereof of the symphony. Ken Trost is here, and let's see, who's the lady you got with you? The young lady.
I'm Nora Conlon.
Nora Conlon, okay, and?
And I'm Margaret Vrolik.
Okay, fine. Well, welcome aboard. This is billed, interestingly, as space music. So does that mean there's a lot of space in the music, or is there something else to it here?
There's a little bit of that. It actually began as a project. I've always wanted the twinkle variations that Suzuki wrote for his beginning violinists to be accompanied by full orchestra instead of the lonely little piano like he wrote it. And I looked around and couldn't find any, so I decided, well, I had to write them. So Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star is, as Suzuki had it in mind for his beginning violinists, was... That was my project. I took a barrier and made it an opportunity. But in the process, I decided not to stop at just the four variations that Suzuki dealt with. And
I've heard you've been in there with your pen.
Like Mozart, I added in a few variations. There's a take five variation. There's a variation that takes a scale that was developed from a 12-tone piece that I wrote. So there's a little funkification there on that. There's there's variations for percussion. There's a silly variation for brass where they play just on their mouthpieces. There's a sort of a whistle variation where the violins play just way up in the stratosphere on harmonics. It's a really neat sound, don't you think, Nara? Nara's a violinist, and actually, so is Margaret. We have two violinists with us here. Anyway, that was the germ. That was the seed there. And I ran into a really nice arrangement of Also Sprach Zarathustra. And I thought, oh.
Otherwise known as the 2001.
The 2001 Space Odyssey theme. And I thought, oh, cool. Well, there's some more sort of spacey music, celestial music. And then going with... 2001, I thought, well, how about the Blue Danube waltzes? Maybe we could do that. And adding to that was, of course, Jupiter fits in there really nicely. And then our soloist said, I really want to play the Philip Glass violin concerto. And I was, ah, perfect. That's going to fit really nicely. If you know anything about Philip Glass, you know it's kind of space-like music.
Yeah. Spacey.
And yeah, so the program really built itself all from Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star.
Now, I'm seeing Nora nod when you were talking about the high violin. Are you a violinist?
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. And so how long have you played with the Juno Student Symphony?
Well, only like two sessions and two seasons.
Now, are you with the symphony itself, or are you part of the incoming group that's playing with the symphony?
I'm just part of the group.
Right? She is actually part of the symphony. Oh, she's
okay.
Part of the
okay.
Juno Student Symphony. Well, Nora, as you recall, at our rehearsal last night, there were about, 55 young violinists and cellists that joined us. Because I did arrange this for the original Twinkle Variations with just that very thought in mind, to get the young people playing with a full orchestra. But Nara's she's the backup orchestra. She's the real thing. She's the real deal.
Now, this used to be called the Juno Youth Symphony, and now it's wonderfully called the Juno Student Symphony. And I think that my other guest here, Margaret, is in the group because it is the Student Symphony. Is that correct?
Right. That's
yeah.
Right.
Her voice is going to tell you that she's probably not the same age as Nora.
That's correct.
We won't go there. So what do you play?
I play the violin too.
Okay,
I'm definitely one of the older members, and I'm very delighted that we do have such an age span within the symphony, because it kind of levels out people by their ability to play.
Mm-hmm.
And we help each other.
And Ken, really, you were the one who switched this around. In other words, when you took it over, it was the Juno Youth Symphony, right? And this was
It was the Juno Youth Symphony, and when I took it over 12 years ago, I just thought it would be really great to open it up to my friends who are my age. And as well, I mean, I love working with children, but... We may do them a little bit of a disservice by putting them all in one room at the same age. Even if you were to put 13 Naras in the same violin section, if you let them play for about 20 minutes, one of those Naras would play a little bit better than the others. And there's just no way you're ever going to get everybody playing exactly at the same level. So why not just scrap that and make it real and have all kinds of ages. And as it turns out, I don't know how it looks from your end, Margaret, or from your end, Nara, but from my part, when I stand on the podium, I see people who are joined from all different backgrounds, all different ages, by their enjoyment of music. And, mm-hmm. and I think it's...
And that's what I see, too.
So, Nora, you're being very quiet. Would you like it to be an all-kid orchestra?
Not really. I like it different ages.
You do?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, Margaret said you help each other. Has someone from the orchestra helped you with your violin?
A lot. There's Kristen. She's very helpful.
How old is Kristen an adult or a child?
Adult.
Oh, okay. And she's worked with you a little bit?
Yeah, she's helped a lot.
The two of you get together and kind of work it out when mm-hmm. the fingering's a little bit strange. Yeah. Okay. Cool. Are there other student symphonies around the country?
That's a good question.
I'm wondering what the ubiquity of this one is.
Not that I can think of right off. But there's no place like Juno either, so...
Yeah, I remember reading an article here recently that basically said that this is a fairly common practice in Europe to bring in the youth mm-hmm. and have them play with symphonies. But it's not a standing thing. It's more like what you're doing with the violin group for this concert. They're brought in for part of a special concert.
Right.
You're a standing orchestra with how many people?
We're 50.
Okay, and across that 50, you've got all ages.
Yeah, the oldest we've ever had, well, it would be indiscreet of me to say exactly, but he's in his 70s, and the youngest we've ever had, we've had several 8-year-olds play with us. Nara, are you not? Are you 10?
Yeah, I'm 10.
Okay, so Nara is at the lower age range,
yeah.
And then at this concert we'll have a few 6-year-olds and 7-year-olds. We're being joined by the students from Guo Sha's studio, as well as Lisa Miles' studio, as well as a student of Margaret's here.
That's right.
Cellists from JAM, Juneau, Alaska Music Matters, the group of string players at Glacier Valley School. And Glacier Valley has actually hosted us.
Well, now I'm understanding
year.
Why you're doing it at Glacier Valley. You need a gymnasium to hold all of the players, right?
Well, and then all their parents and all the people who are going to be coming.
Yeah. So you need a lot of space to make this work.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Hey, can I talk a little bit about the concerto that we're going to be playing?
Would you please?
Philip Glass is a really interesting choice, if I do say so myself. And I can say that because I actually didn't make the choice. I'll give you just a little background. I also teach piano, and my entire older piano studio chose a Philip Glass piece to perform last year. I would have never thought that they were very interested in it, but they loved it. It is. There's something about Philip Glass music that makes teenagers, it just turns them on. And so besides the fact that it fit in with the theme that I'd already set, I was so excited that Robert had chosen this, and Robert Newman is our violin soloist, because it's just enjoyed by that age so much. And I think us old crusty types might listen to it and go, oh, that's not really music. But because there are some people who do love it, everyone is getting introduced to this really interesting music. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. It's considered minimalist music. But interestingly to me, Philip Glass himself said, no, it's not minimalist, it's just repetitive. so it's quite repetitive, and the chord changes move very slowly, and they repeat themselves, and so it sort of sets a texture. It's kind of like looking at a modern painting that you don't see actual images that you recognize, but you see textures and colors, mm-hmm. and you'll hear textures and colors in a way that's even more abstract than music is already.
Let's make sure that people know when they can hear this music, because you really have a varied and wonderful program. This is on Sunday, right?
Sunday,
March 10th at 4:30 in the afternoon. It's at Glacier Valley School. There is a pay-as-you-can at the door admission price.
We'll ask you for whatever you think you can pay at the door, and we're just happy to have you there. That's what's most important.
Okay, and Robert Newman is a young man here from Juneau who's quite active in the art scene. He was part of the bass section on King Island Christmas.
And he was in Annie. He's an amazing guy.
He really is. He has a great voice, in addition to being quite an accomplished violinist, as I understand it. So thank you very, very much. Thank you, Nara, for coming and talking with us. Thank you very much, Margaret. And let's go out with a little bit of what we'll be hearing this weekend, the Strauss Waltz. It's 20 minutes before 4 o'clock. We'll fade Johann Strauss out. We'll remind you that the concert that's being put on this weekend by the Juno Student Symphony will be at Glacier Valley School. It's Sunday afternoon at 4:30. Pay as you can at the door, and they're billing it as a concert of space music with young Robert Newman as an out-of-the-world violinist playing a piece by Philip Glass. So take that in if you can. My next two guests are out of the world at least part of the time and up on the glacier face most of the time. Here are Aaron Hood and Chad O'Neill. They've been doing a week-long seminar, I guess a two-day seminar this last week, combining a number of different disciplines to talk about the effect of glaciers on the environment. And tonight you're going to kind of summarize some of that and talk a little bit about glaciers up at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center, a wonderful setting for that, for the fireside lectures at 6:30 and 8 p.m. So tell us a little bit about the seminar or the panel discussion that you've been doing.
Yeah, so the workshop we had was a two-day workshop. It was sponsored by the Alaska Climate Science Center, and the purpose was really to try to bring together a diverse group of scientists that are working on things related to glaciers. So we had glaciologists, climate people, hydrologists, water chemistry, people who study oceanography, ocean ecology. And so really bringing all these groups together to think about how we can study the impact of glaciers in a more sort of holistic way instead of having everyone do their own thing and not really talk to each other, which has kind of been the model in the past. So the point of this workshop was to bring people together and start to get a dialogue and a framework that we could use to study glaciers more comprehensively.
So, Chad, what was your role in the sessions?
Aaron's the hydrologist, I'm the glaciologist, and together we've been studying how glaciers affect stream flow for the past couple of years, and we wanted to expand because the streams eventually end up in the ocean. And there's a lot of suggestions that impacts the fish and the birds that Alaska's economy hinges on. So we both sort of split the load of rounding up the people to bring here and took turns chairing the workshop and organizing. It wasn't a sit down and listen workshop. It was a scratch your head together, and really we tried to bring together some new ideas. And we also invited several resource managers to the workshop to try and level the playing field between the scientists and the managers so that we're on the same level.
Is there there's an increasing emphasis in some sciences on I guess what they call traditional knowledge? Alaska Native, particularly thinking. Did you bring any of that into your discussions?
You know, we didn't per se in this case, but I have been working with people at the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida on that aspect of it, and Kathy Connor at UAS has done a lot with traditional ecological knowledge and glacier change. And that's actually, it did come up at this workshop, and one of the things that we're hoping to do is to incorporate that more and potentially incorporate some of that into the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center to get sort of more education. So it wasn't really a focus of this workshop, but there are some efforts that we have in Juneau to work on that issue.
It's a real interesting but somewhat difficult kind of to cross the science traditional native barriers. You have to sort of knock down some fences in order for both sides to feel comfortable communicating across the back fence on the behind the house out there.
And I think the big point is just to see what information is out there from whatever perspective it is, and the traditional ecological knowledge is just another perspective that can kind of add value to our understanding. So,
what messages are you bringing forward tonight? What will you be telling folks up at the Glacier Visitors Center?
Well, I think the central message is that glaciers are really a central and very important part of ecosystems here. And we think about the coastal temperate rainforest in southeast Alaska. And, we all know that there's these ice fields sitting up there behind the forest, but we don't always think about that the fact that water moves from the ice fields down the rivers and into the ocean really has these cascading influences down downstream from the glacier itself. And that's a lot of what we're trying to think about, is what are the important processes that we need to understand to help us figure out, as the glaciers change, what are the downstream consequences of that going to be? So that's kind of our central message.
Yeah, I'd echo that. We're also trying to decipher the impacts of how climate change and variability in climate are both important stories in coastal Alaska, where we have highly variable year-to-year changes in climate, stream flow, oceanography. And so at what point does the trend outweigh the variability is one of the things that we worked on. And, you know, it's not very often that a fish biologist walks into my office curious about glaciers, but more and more we're both becoming interested in each other's research. You know, the fishing industry is a central part of the economy in Alaska, and the fresh water that goes into the ocean carries the nutrients that supply the food web all the way up to the fish that we eat for dinner. So that's kind of what we were doing.
Well, this is, you know, people don't, I don't sense, I don't think, unless you're involved in this kind of research, the clubbiness of various science disciplines. But this effort to bring all of these people together is another example of knocking down some fences, because people tend to work very deeply into their own areas, but they do it in isolation from the rest of the areas. They know that there's the circumstances impinge on each other, but because of the intense concentration that science requires, you tend to get narrowed down, and you're looking with a real bright laser light on one particular thing, and the rest of the business kind of fades off into the darkness. So congratulations on a real effort to bring that to the fore. I think a lot of people are going to be comfortable listening to you tonight. The two of you impress me as being not so much great fonts of authority as a couple of guys who know a lot about glaciers and who can just kind of sit around and talk with the folks. And I think that's the beauty of the Fireside Lecture Series.
Yeah, no, I hope it'll be, there's something for everyone. There's pictures of glaciers, whales, rivers, we've got it all in this. So I think it'll be a really, you know, for people that are interested in the ecosystems that we have here, I think there'll be a lot of really interesting information for them. So
the programs are at 6:30 and 8 p.m. this evening. They're at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitors Center. It's the same program,
yes,
repeated.
Yep.
So if you're there, if you can get up there at 6:30, then come to that one. If you have a dinner engagement or something like that and you can't get out until 8 o'clock, it's the same show again with two real stars of the glacial world, I guess we'd call you. Aaron Hood and Shad O'Neill will be up there to talk with their slides and their movies and kind of bring us up to date on the effects of glaciers on our environment here. Thank you so much for coming on the show and telling us about this.
Thank you. All right, thank you.
Thank you. join Friends of Admiralty Island at Dipak Hatchery Saturday, March 9th for discussion and celebration. From 3 to 5, a brown bear forum, a discussion with bear biologists on current population trends and needed research. 6 to 7 is a potluck dinner. From 7 to 8:30, Brown Bears of Admiralty, reflections of a wildlife biologist, John Chain, one of Alaska's premier biologists, will share his photos, field experiences, and passion for Admiralty.
9 minutes before 4 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore, your host today for Juneau Afternoon. My next two guests are a couple of guys who have their heads in the stars. We are honored this week to have Dennis Mamana here in town doing a set of special programs at the Marie Drake Planetarium, and Steve Kosis is here to give us kind of an overview of what he's going to do, and then we're going to get Dennis on the mic. Steve, what's coming up?
Yeah, thanks, Pat. So it's going to be a busy weekend at the Redirect Planetarium. Dennis Mamana is going to do two shows at the planetarium, Friday and Sunday. And Saturday, he's doing a workshop in the Valley at the Shepherd of the Valley Lutheran Church.
Okay. So, Dennis, you're living, I think, in the only community in California that has arranged to darken its skies at night?
Borrego Springs, California, in the Anza Borrego Desert. We are the very first international dark sky community in California.
Well, for an astronomer, that's got to be something close to heaven, huh?
It's pretty nice. We've got, you know, Borrego Springs is a small town. We got 1,000 square miles of desert around us, surrounded by on three sides by mountains. And for being in Southern California, to be able to see as many stars as we do, it's a pretty amazing place.
Well, I should say that if anyone wants to know a good reason for coming to see one of your presentations here in town, all they need to go is to go to your website and just take a look at the photographs. You are an amazing sky photographer.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Yeah.
It's a passion. I've been doing it for 45, 46 years now, and it's what I love doing. There's nothing more alive than being outside at night under a starry sky with a camera.
Now, as I understand it, you're going to do a workshop on photographing the night sky for us in Juneau. Is that the...
I am tomorrow at 10 a.m. at the Marie Drake Planetarium, and in fact, tonight I'm doing a presentation about night sky photography by this international organization called TWAN, The World at Night. It's a group of about 36 of the world's most elite, highly acclaimed night sky photographers. And if you think my stuff is good, thank you very much. I'm very honored to be an invited member of that group. And, there's some amazing things that you can photograph in the night sky.
Well, in particular, not so much from Juneau because we have such a persistent cloud cover here, but Alaska offers some wonderful opportunities to take pictures of the Northern Lights.
It really does. And people think, when they think Alaska night skies, they tend to think of the Northern Lights, which are beautiful. And that's why I come up here every year. But there are so many other things in the night sky, and that's why I thought, you know, this year I'm going to offer a workshop at the planetarium tomorrow, a full-day workshop that will teach people how to actually photograph things in the night sky while they're waiting for the Northern Lights, because, you know, they don't hit Juneau that frequently.
That's certainly true. So what kind of equipment does it take, briefly? I mean, I don't want to take away from the presentation, but do we have to have $1 million worth of cameras?
No, you have to have a camera that can be operated manually. You want to be able to operate manual mode and focus manually, and a tripod.
Huh.
That's it. That's the basis of all you need. And, of course, you can add more as you go along. It's nice to have a wide-angle lens, but a camera and a tripod is pretty much it.
And then, without taking away from what you're going to present at the workshop, what are you going to be able to tell us to do with that camera?
Well, I set up the workshop in three parts. The first part is, what do you do to get ready and to set up? Because a lot of people don't know how to get your camera and tripod set up ready to shoot the night sky. Second part is, what do you do when you're out there actually shooting? How do you do it? What settings do you use? There's so many things that are going on in the sky. How do you decide on your exposures? And the third part, which I think is actually the most important part, is, what do you do after you shoot it? Processing is so incredibly important. If you don't do that, you're never going to get world-class images. So those are the three prongs in the workshop, and those are three very, very important parts of it.
Processing now is largely done digitally.
It's all done digitally, unless you're shooting with film and you're still working in a chemical darkroom. But it is processed digitally, and it's You know, it's Ansel Adams, the great American photographer, spent most of his time in the darkroom processing and editing his film. I think it's a shame that he passed away just before the digital age, because I think he would have jumped into it. You know, this makes it easy for everybody to really get amazing images. And for night sky shooting, you absolutely have to learn processing. There's no question about it.
It sounds like a and you're saying this is an all-day workshop that you're doing.
Yeah, with 10 a.m. to 4:30, and uh-huh. We will take a break for lunch. Sure.
There's a small charge, I think, for it. Is that right, Steve?
Yes, and just to be clear, the workshop is going to be in the Valley, not the planetarium. So the workshop will be at the Valley tomorrow, Saturday, at Shepherd of the Valley Lutheran Church, which is on Menno Hall, Back Loop Road.
You know, we had a couple of nights just like last week when you could have done some night photography here in Juneau.
Yeah, two nights ago it was clear,
but
the solar activity was low, so I didn't see any northern lights.
No, there were no. I was monitoring the solar activity over the weekend, and the K factor stayed way, way down all weekend long. Okay, well, there's other opportunities. There's about three or four opportunities to see you while you're here, Dennis. You're doing this show in Shepherd in the Valley, and then you're doing a couple of shows at the planetarium itself.
Yes, tonight at 7 p.m., Dennis is doing a show
about the world at night, about this elite team of night sky photographers. And I'm going to be showing photographs that will, if you see this program and see these photos, you will never look at the night sky the same again. I promise you.
Amazing. Okay, we just have a couple of seconds more. I don't think I started out by saying welcome to Juneau, but it's really nice to have you back here.
Oh, thank you. I love Juneau.
You pass through us fairly often because you take trips up north to Fairbanks, I think.
Every year. Every year I come back to Alaska. It's my home away from home.
And you bring a few people up with you.
This year I've got a couple dozen people that are coming up there with me, and actually about four dozen. And we always go up, look for the northern lights. I lecture about the lights. I teach people how to photograph them.
Unfortunately, we have run out of time, which is always I wish we didn't, but we are. And so I'm going to just make sure that everyone knows the times and places. 7 p.m. tonight, the show
7 p.m. tonight at the planetarium.
Okay.
And Saturday, the workshop's in the Valley at Shepherd of the Valley Lutheran Church. And Sunday night, 6:30 p.m. This is a great opportunity to learn from a master.
Outstanding. Thank you very much. This is KTOO Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. We also broadcast on these translators in the Valley and Auk Bay. You can tune K276 AF at 103.1 MHz. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, we're at K269 AO at 101.7. Gustavus hears us on K201 AM at 88.1 MHz. K220 BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, you can hear KTOO on K210 AS at 89.9 MHz. In Juneau, you can also get KTOO on GCI Cable Juneau. We're on digital channel 871. KRNN, our sister station, is on 872, and KXLL is on 873. Tomorrow on Juneau Monday on Juneau Afternoon, Joan Pardis will be hosting. She'll talk with Sarah Buhlman about this Saturday's Saga Day of Play. She'll get a preview of Sunday's concert by Ladysmith Black Mambazo. Friday's performance of the Juneau Wind Ensemble, and Joe Carson will come in with a preview of his Wednesday night reading of old and new stories. And she'll have Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, and a lot more on Juneau Afternoon on Monday afternoon at 3 o'clock. Pat Moore, been your host today. Really enjoyed it. Thanks to all my guests, and thank you all for tuning in.